We can't work with you guys. Yet Gates ultimately decided that Jobs' role in the Macintosh was heroic. People concentrate on finding the guy's flaws. Why, he said. He's in the center of things. They ask, does he know the instruction set of the 68,000? I don't think that's super important. There's no way there would be anything like that Macintosh without Jobs. Microsoft was only the beginning of Apple's third-party effort. The goal was to have 500 applications out into the marketplace by the time Macintosh had been out for a year, and to double that the next year. As stated in the product introduction, we must introduce with two things: a set of software which makes Mac immediately useful in key markets, and the unmistakable impression that Mac is the industry leader upon which all worthwhile software will appear in the future. Macintosh's new marketing manager, Mike Murray, called the people charged with building the third-party development effort software evangelists. The first was former Hewlett-Packard engineer Mike Boych, followed by Elaine Rossman, then Guy Kawasaki. All three went on to become entrepreneurs, though Kawasaki somehow wandered astray and became a computer columnist. Kawasaki later provided the pithiest job description of evangelists. We were Apple's kamikazes, who used fervor, zeal, and anything else to convince software developers to create Macintosh products. We sold the Macintosh dream. The software developers who bought into the dream, and only some did, created products that changed Macintosh's principal weakness, a lack of software, into its greatest strength, the best collection of software for any personal computer. The easiest part of their job was taking the prototype to potential software developers. People were uniformly blown away, Boych told me in 1983. I remember one guy who had just designed what he thought was a good accounting program. After seeing the Mac, he felt like he had just designed the best propeller in the world and saw a jet fly by. Early in the process, the evangelist visited a fledgling Cambridge, Massachusetts software outfit called Lotus Development Corporation. They were unimpressed with his new product, a spreadsheet called 123, though better than its predecessors, it still used obscure commands and codes stuck in the pre-Macintosh mold of computing. Yet, Apple's evangelists liked Lotus's founder, Mitch Kapoor, who greeted them by saying, "I'd sell my mother to get a Mac." Apple later gave him a prototype without that stipulation, and Lotus began working on an ambitious project for the Mac called Jazz. By the time the Mac launched, Lotus had become the world's biggest personal computer software company, having established 123 as the essential application for the IBM PC. Yet Kapoor was crazy about the Macintosh. "The IBM is a machine you could respect," he told me at the time. "The Macintosh is a machine you can love." Every so often, the frazzled Macintosh team would leave Bandley 3 and check into a hotel for a retreat. Most often, Jobs picked cushy resorts down the coast in Monterey or Carmel. Each retreat began with a lecture cum pep talk by Jobs. This set the tone for the event, which would proceed with presentations. On one occasion, Burl Smith announced he didn't have 10 minutes worth of things to say, so he played his guitar to fill up the time. Discussion sessions, a guest speaker, and often the sort of rowdy misbehavior associated with heavy metal rock bands. After a display of fires on the beach and midnight skinny dipping, one resort banished the Mac team from future performances. A second venue blackballed Apple after Mac people commandeered the dessert carts, using the elegant creamy concoctions as fodder for a food fight. Jobs' speeches were punctuated by slogans. It was on one such retreat that he originally encouraged the Mac team to consider themselves pirates. In another speech, he wrote on a large easel that the journey is the reward. Only a cynic would interpret the flip side of this maxim: no big bonuses. But there were few cynics on board. The Mac people were consumed in their quest to make history, hyper-aware of the specialness of their enterprise. They knew Apple would reap ungodly financial dividends from their labors, but that wasn't the point at all. They believed Macintosh would be a dividend to the entire world. That is what drove them, made their sacrifice worthwhile, and made the whole thing a jolly little enterprise. "Very few of us were even 30 years old," one of them told Esquire. "We all felt as though we had missed the civil rights movement. We had missed Vietnam. What we had was the Macintosh." These were the best days of their lives, and they knew it. Perhaps the most telling epigram of all was a three-word koan that Jobs scrawled on an easel in January 1983, when the project was months overdue. Real Artists Ship. It was an awesome encapsulation of the ground rules in the age of technological expression. The term starving artist was now an oxymoron. One's creation, quite simply, did not exist as art if it was not out there, available for consumption, doing well. Was Engelbart an artist? A prima donna. He didn't ship. What were the Wizards of Park? Haughty aristocrats. They didn't ship. The final step of an artist, the single validating act, was getting his or her work into boxes, at which point the marketing guys take over. Once you get the computers in people's homes, you have penetrated their minds. At that point, all the clever design decisions you made, all the twists and turns of the interface, the subtle dance of mode and modeless, the menu bars and trash cans and mouse buttons and everything else inside and outside your creation becomes part of people's lives, transforms their working habits, permeates their approach to their labors, and ultimately their lives. But to do that, to make a difference in the world and a dent in the universe, you had to ship. You had to ship. You had to ship. Real artists ship. Chapter 7. On January 22nd, during the third quarter of the otherwise unmemorable Super Bowl between the Oakland Raiders and the Washington Redskins, a cut to a commercial turned the nation's television sets over to some extremely weird images. Bald-headed drones marched down a long tube-like corridor to some hellish auditorium. They had shaved heads and pajama-like garments reminiscent of concentration camp victims. Guards in shiny helmets monitored their actions. On a large screen, a fierce-looking, almost crazed speaker, Big Brother himself, was spouting cant that, if you could make it out, was truly frightening. Each of you is a single cell in the great body of the state. And today, that great body has purged itself of parasites. We have triumphed over the unprincipled dissemination of facts. The thugs and wreckers have been cast out. Let each and every cell rejoice, for today we celebrate the first glorious anniversary of the Information Purification Directive. We have created, for the first time in all history, a garden of pure ideology where each worker may bloom secure from the pests purveying contradictory and confusing truths. Our unification of thought is more powerful a weapon than any fleet or army on earth. We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause. Our enemies shall talk themselves to death, and we will bury them with their own confusion. We shall prevail. This is a world clearly dominated by an evil, monolithic information beast. But wait. Intercut with a speech, we see a solitary figure of hope. A young woman in bright red shorts and a t-shirt with the Macintosh Picasso logo. She carries a sledgehammer. At the end of the speech, she bursts into the room, races down the aisle, and flings the sledgehammer into the screen. The Big Brother image evaporates in a white-hot explosion. Apocalypse! The inmates are stunned in slack-jawed amazement, and on the screen, not the screen just destroyed, but the television screens of 43 million people watching the Super Bowl, appear the following words. On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh, and you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984. This was the notorious 1984 spot. Directed by Ridley Scott, it had all the cyberpunk film noir of his recent cult hit Blade Runner and a more coherent plot. IBM takes a fall. It cost $500,000 to film. Scott recruited an Olympic athlete to hurl the hammer and London skinheads as audience extras. Apple Computer bought airtime for it only twice, once late in December in an obscure television market somewhere on the Great Plains, so that it would be eligible for the inevitable awards of the new year, and the other during the Super Bowl. But Apple's board of directors, by and large aging white men unattuned to the semiotics of video clips, had hated it. Apple tried to sell off its commitment. Only at the last minute, when his advertising agency couldn't resell the time slot, did the company finally draw in its gut and give the okay to air the 1984 spot. It turned out to be one of the most famous commercials ever aired. The network news shows even did reports on it. Later, Apple's John Sculley would speak of the advertisement as if he had known its power all along, as an example of event marketing. Long after people forgot who played in that Super Bowl, they remembered the commercial. It was Apple's first official public acknowledgement that Macintosh existed. Real artists ship. Those words must have been ringing in the ears of Mac team designers in Jobs' mocking, whining cadence for weeks before the scheduled launch. When I visited Banley 3 in November 1983, the atmosphere was a mix of euphoria and panic. While most key components of Macintosh had been finished for weeks or even months, others were still unresolved, notably those concerning the system software that was contained on floppy disks included with the machine. The least finished part of the Macintosh was the Finder, the part of the system software visible to the user. It was through the Finder that the Macintosh magic would first appear, where even the most computer-phobic user could instantly get to work, wielding the mouse to launch programs, put files in folders, delete or copy documents, and eponymously find things. Bruce Horn had been working on it for months, and when it became apparent that he would need assistance, Steve Capps began to augment his work. If sending a dozen programmers to Horn's aid would have helped matters, Apple would have done it. But the nature of the Finder was such that even adding a single programmer invited an extra level of complexity. The Finder was a balancing act. A relatively small program had to interact with countless other programs, almost all of which had not yet been written, perform tricky tasks, follow the Macintosh religion chapter and verse, and above all, refrain from crashing. "It's like the soundtrack to films," Horn explained. "If you don't know it's there, it's good." This was close work. Sending Capps in was like lowering a rescuer into a cave with prayers that two people would emerge alive. Since the Finder was so crucial and so far behind schedule, Capps and Horn did not participate in the orgy of pre-release publicity hoopla. They were de facto exiles, in quarantine across the street from Banley 3, sequestered in a small room they called the Finder Ghetto. When I visited in November, I could instantly sense the hysteria. The room was littered with junk food detritus. Capps and Horn, however, put on a cheerful demeanor. Horn mentioned some tricky revision they had just implemented. "Here we are, sliding down the guillotine," said Capps, wearing shorts and high-top sneakers, "and we make a radical change." Not so cheerful was Randy Wigginton, the chief author of MacWrite, the word processor to be shipping with every Macintosh. He looked like death. "Sleep deprivation," he explained, a syndrome that had recently led him to cut his work hours from 19 hours a day to a mere 14. In those rare times he did sleep, a monkey program would be working the Macintosh, typing gibberish, perhaps eventually Hamlet, into MacWrite. If the program did not crash, that was victory. Producing MacWrite had been a struggle. The word processor was not only to be one of only two truly practical applications immediately available, the other being Microsoft Spreadsheet Multiplan, but was also meant to stand as an example of how a good program could make use of Mac's interface. This was a considerable burden, especially since producing software for Macintosh was several orders of magnitude harder than for less sophisticated systems. This was something that hundreds of would-be Mac programmers would torturously learn. Easy to use, hard to program. Word processors were particularly tricky. Displaying a single line of text on other computers is simple. "Normally you just say, 'Write,'" explained Wigginton. "But on Macintosh, it becomes extremely complex. What font is it? What size? You have to measure each character on the screen. Lines are variable heights, and then you have to worry about handling pictures in the middle of the document." All sorts of interface issues were still in flux. One of the features of MacWrite, meant to be a standard for all applications, was the ability to save a file under a different name. The open question was, which of the two, the original file or the newly named file, should be the one remaining on the screen, ready for more text? "There are extremely good reasons for each way," Wigginton said, but a poll of the Mac team decided that the renamed file would be the one remaining visible. There were a lot of those questions still hanging. The state of the Finder, still somewhat amorphous at a perilously late date, made those problems worse. It seemed that every time Capps and Horn made a change, the effect would interfere with something MacRae was doing and cause the program to crash. We've been working on this so long, it's a dream to be almost finished, but in some ways it's a nightmare, said Wigginton. I'm really terrified. If I really have my way, the word processor wouldn't go out for 6 months. But it has to be done now. Sometimes at night, I wake up in a cold sweat. Thousands and thousands of people are going to be using this. To a large extent, I am responsible for a $1 billion company. As the final deadline approached, Caps and Horn were staying up 58 hours straight, blasting Dead Kennedys records, gobbling vitamin C like popcorn. Caps would blow off steam by playing video games. Furious sessions with Defender, at which he was an adept, second perhaps only to Burl Smith. Horn would just sit there and scream, top of his lungs. Working at his home one day, Bill Atkinson became so frustrated at the state of the Finder that he yanked the mouse cord from the machine and threw the pointing device at the wall, making a serious dent in it. They're going to ruin my project, he wailed. Mike Murray liked charts. Macintosh's head of marketing, a Stanford MBA hired by Steve Jobs after minimal experience in Hewlett-Packard's office in Corvallis, Oregon, would get an interviewer into his office, and the interviewer would be embargoed. This meant that he or she could not write a word about Macintosh until January 23rd, a day before the official introduction adjusted for the schedule of the newsweeklies, and then Murray would go for the charts. He would draw something that looked like a mountain, the Matterhorn perhaps, and identify it as a bell-shaped curve. It represented the acceptance of personal computers. He would identify a point very near the left of the shape when the slope was still low and proclaim this was our present location on the curve, with only 5% of the population in that little foothill. These were the risk-oriented early adopters. There were only so many of these, however, and everyone else was still distrustful of computers because they were so hard to use. But now we were on the cusp of the Macintosh era, he'd say, where computers are no longer an end to themselves, but a means to an end, a tool, an appliance, a computer for the rest of us. Now, the bulk of people, those who would drive the curve up the mountain peak and ring the curve-shaped bell, would be computer customers. These, he would say, echoing Doug Engelbart's prediction a decade before, were the knowledge workers, the target market for Mac. Our definition of knowledge worker is someone who sits behind a desk and plans to take information and crunch it with ideas, he'd say. Then he would mention the philosophical dream. The philosophical dream is, how do we do something that will improve people's lives? Murray would pause and confide that you don't find that in any other computer company. And then Mike Murray would look at you. He had slightly mussy brown hair and a neatly trimmed mustache, sort of like Paul McCartney in the Sgt. Pepper days, and big watery eyes. He was not yet 30 years old, and he was in charge of selling a product that would determine the fate of a $1 billion company. If we fail, he'd say, it will be a sad story. I'll cry. Steve Jobs was convinced that Macintosh was the final showdown of the computer corral. It was Apple versus IBM, to the death. He was annoyed at having to defend Macintosh from industry pundits' criticism that it was not compatible with software that ran on IBM's disk operating system. In retrospect, this complaint seems ludicrous, like criticizing tractors because they do not require oxen. But at that time, with many having declared IBM the unassailable leader in personal computing, the consensus was that launching a computer that did not run IBM standard software was folly. Jobs, of course, had his own perspective. If we don't do it, IBM is going to take over, he said. If having really great products, much better products than theirs, isn't enough to compete with them, then they'll have the whole thing. They'll have the greatest monopoly of all time. It'll be like owning every oil company and every car company in 1920. If we don't do this, nobody can stop IBM. It's kind of like watching a gladiator going into the arena. It's really being perceived as Apple's do or die. Jobs went on, talking about his motivation. I'm not doing this for the money, he explained. I have more money than I could ever, hopefully, even give away in my lifetime. And I'm certainly not doing it for my ego. I'm doing it because I love it. And I'm doing it because I love the people. And I'm doing it because I love the idea of making a great $10 billion company. If we fail, That will mean my entire worldview is all wrong, and my judgment about people is all wrong. If this is another failure, then I should question my work. I should go write poetry or something, go climb a mountain. It was clear that Stephen Paul Jobs did not expect to be composing strophes or scaling K2. He was already convinced the battle was over. Apple had won. Every bone in my body says it's going to be great, and that people are going to realize that and buy it. You see, this job isn't done until we've sold several million of these things. When do you think that will happen? I wanted to know. 85, he said confidently. I think we'll break the cumulative 2 million total in 1985. Sure. In early January 1984, 1 week before the absolutely final day for the floppies to ship, the software was still crashing. The frustrated engineers called Steve Jobs, who by then was in New York promoting Macintosh. Jerome Coonan, one of the software engineers, spoke for the entire team. They had failed. The smart thing was for everyone to get some sleep, come back in a couple days with a fresh perspective, and finish the software then. Meanwhile, the Macs could be shipped to stores without finished software. In 2 or 3 weeks or so, when the rejuvenated team completed a bug-free release, Apple could Federal Express disks to the stores, which would slip them in the boxes. Granted, the machine would not be available for customers to buy right away, but how many Macintoshes were we talking about here? Each of around 1,500 dealerships had an initial allotment of 2 computers. Of those 2, the store probably would want to keep one to run demos for future customers who would buy later in the month when Apple flooded the pipelines with Macs. So, Coonan concluded, all they were really talking about was 1,500 possible sales. In a couple of weeks, they would get the bugs out, and it would be as if no problem had existed. Steve Jobs listened, and then he answered. They would ship in 1 week, period. Whatever state the software was in next Monday would be the final state. They had to fix it. We all walked out of the room and said, well, we've got to finish it, Steve Capps later recalled. No one slept for another week. On January 16th, when the finished floppies were to be sent out for production, a frantic software team had worked all night, but at 9 a.m., the software was still crashing. A few hours later, the bleary-eyed programmers produced a new version of MacWrite that seemed, if not robust, sturdy enough to perform its basic tasks without generating bomb boxes. Good enough to ship. Within hours, the machines rolled off the lines of the new $20 million Macintosh factory in Fremont, California, and were set inside the boxes, upon each of which was emblazoned the colorful, Picasso-esque line drawing of the Macintosh. In every box was a main unit, a mouse, a keyboard, software, and a guided tour audio cassette, where a soothing instructor talked you through the Macintosh basics, accompanied by Windham Hill recording artists, including Sonambulance superstars George Winston and Will Ackerman. The boxes went all over the country and were sitting in stores, waiting to be whisked away by customers on January 25th. They were real artists at last. It was not until the very last moment that Apple set the price of the insanely great computer that would determine why 1984 was not going to be like 1984. For most of the past few months, the Macintosh's cost was the subject of a heated internal struggle. Steve Jobs wanted it $1,995, a price sufficient to make money, but low enough to interest masses of users who weren't even thinking of buying a computer. John Sculley hoped to boost short-term profits by pricing it at $2,495. Jobs thought he had won. I could get $2,495 for everyone I make for 6 to 9 months, he told me in November, but I'd rather really make this the next revolution, so we're forsaking some profits. But deep into January, Sculley finally prevailed. Macintosh will cost $2,495. On January 24th of the annual stockholders meeting, every one of the 2,571 seats at the Flint Center at De Anza College, a mere microchip's throw away from Bandley 3 in the Apple campus, was filled, and latecomers had to settle for cyberspace seating via a specially arranged telecast. The first 4 rows had long been reserved for the Macintosh team, garbed in the latest of the seemingly limitless variations of the Macintosh t-shirt. At 10 o'clock, in strolled Steve Jobs, wearing a double-breasted jacket and a red bow tie. he recited a verse from Bob Dylan's The Times They Are A-Changin'. Then, since this was the official stockholders' meeting and only unofficially a high-tech revival meeting, he brought in some Apple directors to conduct some corporate business. The trivialities of a business enjoying its first billion-dollar year disposed of, Jobs re-entered and introduced himself. The mounting hysteria in the room as he spoke was reminiscent of Ed Sullivan's crescendoed introduction of the Beatles almost exactly 20 years before. "It is 1958," he said. "IBM passes up the chance to buy a young, fledgling company that has just invented a new technology called xerography. 2 years later, Xerox is born, and IBM has been kicking itself ever since." He continued with his lesson in computer history, citing IBM's initial failure to recognize the market in mini-computers, then personal computers. He mentioned the dire shakeout that was currently decimating the industry, with only Apple and IBM standing as giants. "It is now 1984, Jobs said, his voice building. "It appears IBM wants it all. IBM wants it all, and is aiming its guns on its last obstacle to industry control, Apple. Will Big Blue dominate the entire computer industry, the entire information age? Was George Orwell right?" "No," the crowd screamed back. At the invocation of Orwell's name, the lights dimmed and the 1984 commercial came on. After that 60-second apocalypse, Jobs slowed his cadence. He spoke about the amazing attributes of the product he was about to announce. Then the crowd began to come alive again as the speakers boomed the neo-Wagnerian strains of Vangelis's score from Chariots of Fire, and out of a canvas bag, the same sort of bag that Barbara Culkin dragged into the conference room at Bandley 3 for my own first exposure, Stephen Paul Jobs pulled out the computer that meant the future of his company and portended something for all our futures. "I'd like to let the Macintosh speak for itself," he said. The synthesized sound capabilities of the machine were up to the challenge. "Hello," it said. "I am Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag." Chapter 8. It almost failed. For the first 100 days, the time that Apple considered essential to establish Macintosh as a new standard of computing, sales had run close to the company's projections. Customers willing to live on the edge purchased approximately 72,000 units. But the buyers were mostly charter members of the class of consumer dubbed early adopters. These, as any MBA knows, were well-off technophiles who debated the merits of Saabs and BMWs, who knew what digital audio tape was, whose reading habits leaned heavily towards Scientific American and sharper image catalogs. Plain old adopters bided their time. Belated adopters kept using their typewriters. The Macintosh factory kept churning out gorgeous boxes that gathered dust in dealerships. The Mac slowly twisted in the wind, and Apple Computer was suddenly an endangered species. The rest of us weren't buying. I recall meeting John Sculley just a day or so before the 100-day rollout was completed. I asked whether the Macintosh had reached its goals, whether everything was on track, and he responded with forced enthusiasm that things could not be better. But he knew even then that Apple marketing efforts had hit a wall. Before the black period ended, Apple would experience months where it moved no more than 5,000 Macs, less than a tenth of Steve Jobs' predictions. I recently asked Joanna Hoffman, the first Macintosh marketer, why the computer performed so poorly in its first year. She laughed. "It's a miracle that it sold anything at all." This was a computer with a single disk drive, no memory capacity, and almost no applications. People who bought it did so on seduction. It was not a rational buy. It was astonishing that Macintosh sold as many as it did. As Hoffman indicated, Macintosh, in its nascent form, had some serious problems. People like myself, who bought Macintoshes in 1984, were so delighted with the machine's virtues that we stubbornly tolerated its faults. But late at night, when nobody could hear us, we secretly despaired about them. Science fiction writer Douglas Adams once wrote a neat description of how the siren song of early Macintosh led to frustration. I can remember when we first met. A group of people were crowded around a small beige-colored box that looked like a toy. I watched, at first with mild curiosity, then gradually I began to feel that kind of roaring, tingling, floating sensation, which meant I had my first experience of Mac paint. But what I, and I think everyone else who bought the machine in the early days, fell in love with was not the machine itself, which was ridiculously slow and underpowered, but a romantic idea of the machine. And that romantic idea had to sustain me through the realities of actually working on the 128K Mac. Adams was on the mark at identifying the dark side of Macintosh's chipper personality. Ridiculously slow and underpowered. Both faults were a consequence of insufficient resources to store information, both in the machine's internal memory and disk storage components. The combination made the computer very slow. Opening application seemed to take more time than the last minute of an NBA game, and in some ways unwieldy, particularly for a device touted as an ultra-glide journey in previously uncharted realms of user-friendliness. At times, it was an embarrassment. The height of indignity was this. This state-of-the-art computer, costing thousands of dollars, put you through a living hell when you attempted the simple act of copying a disk. Disk swapping, as Macintosh owners quickly learned, was a new high-tech form of torture. The simple operation of copying the contents of one disk to another was a flirtation with tendinitis. Ironically, as far as the human interface was concerned, this task was easier than it had ever been. This was not the case with IBM and Microsoft's operating system. With DOS, it was extremely easy to wind up with a floppy disk in each hand, asking yourself which was A and which was B, knowing that if you guess wrong, you might wipe out your business plan. On the Mac, one simply gripped the mouse, selected the icon for the disk to be copied, and dragged the mouse over the icon that represented a new disk. Like almost every operation performed on the Mac, it was much harder to describe than perform. The problems came from the hardware inadequacies. With only one disk in operation at a time and too few RAM chips in the computer, the process was akin to using a thimble to transfer water from one bucket to another. Say you had a few folders full of files on a disk you had named Fred. You wanted to copy the contents to another disk. Call the second disk Fred Redux. Once you had the icons for both disks on the screen, you'd make sure Fred was snugly in the floppy slot and begin the process. First, you would wait for Macintosh to read a small bit of information from Fred into its meager memory. Then Macintosh would prompt you to eject Fred and insert Fred Redux. You'd hear the disk whir as Macintosh accessed the information it had remembered and wrote it on the Fred Redux disk. Then you ejected Fred Redux, put Fred back in, and the process would repeat. How many times would you have to shuttle the two Freds in and out of the floppy slot? A reviewer for Byte reported more than 50 disk swaps and 20 minutes to copy a single disk. The problems of speed and storage cast a shadow on almost every task the new Macintosh users performed. Consider the word processor, Mac Write. Because of the Mac's limitations, it was impossible to construct a file that ran for much longer than 8 printed pages. Ever try to write a novel in 8-page chunks? I once sat in on an early meeting of the New York Macintosh Users Group, in which several would-be fiction writers had a discussion on how to do just that. Their novels, they agreed, would all be broken into brief chapters. Not an ideal solution. How did this happen? How could a product, which in so many ways was indeed insanely great, be, in other respects, simply insane? Hadn't the Mac team known about those problems? They had, and they had not. On an intellectual level, they had understood what was happening, but their devotion to the Macintosh dream drove them deep into denial. In a sense, they were paralyzed by a shared illusion generated by overexposure to Steve Jobs's reality distortion field. The problem actually began with Jeff Raskin, who envisioned Macintosh as a stripped-down machine, sort of a toaster with a keyboard, with no more memory than the borderline obsolete computers of 1980. When Steve Jobs ascended to the Macintosh throne, he quickly realized that in order to accommodate Lisa technology, Mac's memory needed bolstering, but he did not bolster it enough. Jobs' parsimony was rooted in a worldview shaped in the early days of personal computing, where very little memory meant quite a lot. The first computers discussed at the Homebrew Computer Club, Steve Wozniak's home base, had 4K memory, the rough equivalent of 4 pages of text. When the Apple II shipped with 48K memory, it was deemed an enormous expanse. Later, Apple II users would buy circuit boards to add 16K more, and then they really felt they were humming. So it is not surprising that Jobs felt 128K sufficient. But there were two errors to his thinking. First, since Macintosh was a bitmap machine, considerably more memory was required than with a raster-based Apple II or IBM PC. When one of these displayed a word, it used a shortcut. There was a single one-byte computer code for each letter, and that chunk of code threw the letter on the screen. But Macintosh, like the Alto that inspired it, did things the hard way. Instead of using a one-byte code, it actually drew the letter, pixel by pixel. While this allowed much more flexibility and made it possible to get what you see, it consumed many more bytes of memory. As a result, much of Macintosh's memory was devoted to keeping the image on the screen. In addition, the Macintosh system software made its own considerable claims on RAM real estate. Since the interface was constantly on the screen, some of the programs that kept it going had to be stored in the memory at all times. Macintosh RAM was like the national budget. By the time you accounted for the mandatory components like debt, entitlements to the military, there really wasn't much left. Lisa solved the problem by shipping with over 1,000K memory, a megabyte. The first Macintosh did not solve the problem at all. The second mistake was overestimating the cost of memory. The price of computer memory chips faithfully follows Moore's Law. Named after Gordon Moore, a co-founder of Intel, the law stipulates that in any two-year computing cycle, power doubles and price halves. This happens because while chip materials are consistently cheap, scientists are constantly figuring out how to squeeze more function on the thumbnail-sized silicon wafers. So the initial cost of shipping a so-called fat Macintosh with 512K memory might have been steep, but Apple could have reliably anticipated a steep drop in price. As it was, Jobs forbade his hardware team to provide even the capability to expand to 512K. Fortunately, Burrell Smith defied him, and by launch time, Jobs was able to address critics by promising a fat Mac early in 1985. In fact, Jobs himself had used the jimmied-up fat Mac at the official introduction. The original Mac, with its anemic memory limitations, simply would not have been capable of performing his demonstration tasks that day. Jobs was also behind Macintosh's lack of a hard disk drive. In early 1982, Joanna Hoffman had written a memo arguing that the Macintosh needed a hard disk drive, more memory, a bigger screen. Later that day, walking down Banley Drive, she saw Jobs, almost a block away. As soon as he spotted her, he began gesticulating frantically. He yelled that she was a Xerox bigot, enamored of big machines. Didn't she realize the small was beautiful? Jobs also knew that putting a hard disk in Macintosh meant that machine would require an internal fan to keep temperature down, and he thought that the resulting noise would be inelegant. His arguments brought her around. So compelling was the reality distortion field that a year later, when Hoffman was preparing business plans for the Macintosh, she had on her desk an Apple III computer with a profile hard disk containing over 10 times the storage of a Macintosh disk, which was constantly running out of space. And she never considered that this phenomenon suggested a problem with the dogma universally accepted by the Bandley Pirates. No one needs a hard disk. So Macintosh shipped without the proper infrastructure to support a hard disk drive, a device that turned out to be an essential requirement for a Mac. Even Alan Kay, having been lured to Cupertino as an Apple Fellow, wrote a scathing critique of the Macintosh for John Sculley, calling it, "Would you buy a Honda with a 1 gallon gas tank?" Sculley, still not quite up to speed about personal computer technology, stuck the memo in a drawer. Kay had actually intended his screed to be constructive. He called the Mac the first personal computer worth criticizing. And from Alan Kay, this was high praise indeed. In retrospect, the Mac wizards chalk up the faults of their masterpiece to hubris. "In our efforts to change the world, we were a little arrogant and unwilling to listen," Bill Atkinson later explained. There was a feeling that Lisa, with his expensive memory and hard disk drive, got out of hand. We didn't want fat Lisa-like programs, too bloated. One of the things we did was set religion, but we never realized how precarious things were. Mac could have died. Even though my wrists still occasionally ache from those nightmarish bouts of disk swapping in the spring of 1984, I'm inclined to defend Steve Jobs of the Mac Group and recognize their mistakes and excesses as a consequence of venturing to the edge. If we are willing to concede that the Mac designers were artists, we must allow them the stubbornness with which any paradigm-smashing iconoclast adheres to his or her founding precepts. Besides, the root of Macintosh's dismal sales performance was not ultimately attributable to his memory and storage problems, but to a fear of the unknown. For many potential buyers, the graphical interface was simply too weird. People often would dismiss the entire gestalt of Macintosh by opining that, "I don't really like the mouse," without a fair-minded immersion in the experience. Perhaps the biggest red herring was the Macintosh's conspicuous lack of cursor keys, the four extra keys on the board that move the electronic pen nib right, left, up, and down. Critics would cite this omission as evidence that the Macintosh designers were elitists who had little truck with those in the trenches who actually used computers. Those people supposedly cherished cursor keys and took deep offense at their absence on the Macintosh. The critics had a point. Cursor keys can be useful, but there are also things to be said for Jobs' intransigence on this point. Donald Norman, in his book, The Psychology of Everyday Things, discusses various methods by which designers intentionally limit what a user might do. These are called forcing devices. An example would be a keyhole shaped in such a way that one can physically insert the key only right side up. In Steve Jobs' mind, the proper way to move a cursor was with the mouse. If users accustomed to cursor keys purchased Macintosh computers and maintained their outdated cursor key habits, it would take them longer to master the mouse, the key component in the interface. And cursor key jockeys would never come to accept what Steve Jobs believed, that no case existed where a cursor key was superior to the mouse. Jobs realized that merely publishing this information in a manual would be insufficient incentive to hew this line. People would succumb to temptation and revert to familiar, if inefficient, form, so Jobs denied them the opportunity. The omission also acted as a forcing device for Macintosh software developers. Joanna Hoffman later explained, "We wanted very much to discourage people from porting their current applications over to the Macintosh. We wanted them to develop new applications from scratch, applications that would closely follow our interface guidelines. Cursor keys would be a temptation to retain old habits." In later revisions of the Macintosh, cursor keys would not be deemed such an abomination. When you're trying to spread a religion, you have to be pretty strict at first. After you get them converted, you can relax, Joanna Hoffman said, long after the omission of cursor keys contributed to the accumulation of the best software library in the world, based on Macintosh religion. That software library was slow in coming, however. Creating a new application for the Macintosh was a difficult process. Prospective software developers had to learn the secrets of the toolbox so they could follow the guidelines for human interface. And then they had to make it look great, better than anything that existed on personal computers before the Mac. By creating Mac Paint and Mac Write, Apple at one swoop had bestowed upon developers both a blessing and a curse. They used the Mac interface so elegantly that any self-respecting developer would be ashamed to release the same ugly, hard-to-use programs that had been the previous standard. A few did, and were promptly hooted out of existence. Macintosh finally did get superior software, but it took months longer than anyone expected. As a result, if one had any motivation to shoot down the Macintosh in 1984, he or she could not have asked for a bigger target. Forget that its cursor keys were missing in action, and its adherents and designers were a bit, flaky. Where was the software? For the longest time, you could buy only a paint program, a word processor that couldn't handle a file larger than 10 pages, and a rather underpowered, albeit easy-to-use, spreadsheet. Although Apple sold modems to connect Macintoshes to telephone lines, For months, the only telecommunications program available was MacTep, written by hacker Dennis Brothers for his personal use and given away free, samizdat style. Maybe I should have put a message in there, "Please send $35," Brothers later joked. Instead of software, you had Steve Jobs going coast to coast, promising the 500 people were working on software. For all these shortcomings, Apple took its lumps. But what was ultimately the most harmful assessment of the Macintosh came from the people in charge of buying computers for large corporations, the Fortune 1000. These Management Information Services, MIS, managers lived by an unwritten code. One would never, ever go wrong by sticking to whatever IBM called the standard. When Macintosh appeared, they were quick in invoking the code, as if holding a crucifix to ward off a vampire. And then they hit Macintosh with their best shot. This was not, they claimed, a computer. It was a toy. Actually, Apple had been terrified that people would dismiss Macintosh as just that, a toy. There was some substance to the charge. It was fun to use, after all. The wizards designing Macintosh considered it an open invitation to childlike play and judged that ability among its chief attributes. Early Macintosh marketers had urged development of a minimum of two Macintosh-quality games, unlike the world has ever seen. The playful side of the Macintosh personality is important for several reasons, read an early business plan. It further endears the office user to his Mac, titillates the college user, and provides a reason for office types to carry their Macs home to their family. Yet by 1984, the company was ferociously down-pedaling Mac playfulness. Mention games to an Apple publicist, and pearls of sweat would appear on her forehead. The Macintosh, she'd stammer, is a serious machine. It was as if the company, by eschewing the machine's perceived childish aspects, was determined to establish the manhood of Macintosh. But the testosterone issue was lost already. The previous paradigm of computing, command-based, batch process, barely coherent, was deeply associated in the MIS community with masculinity. One's virility was associated with the gunmetal boxes and dense, non-intuitive interfaces of those dense beasts. If you weren't familiar with aprompts, if you didn't know what config sys meant, you had no hair on your chest. Even women, when it came to computing, had to have hair on their chests, at least virtually. And what kind of person used a mouse? A wimp, obviously. Some new-age softy who babbled about using the right side of his or her brain. Columnist John Dvorak contrasted the Mac with a new version of IBM's computer, the AT, and called the latter a man's computer, designed by men for men. An InfoWorld pundit in 1984 encapsulated the Mac's problem. In spite of its impressive capabilities, the Mac simply doesn't have the look and feel of a business computer. The commentator identified a precedent for the Macintosh's dilemma: 19th-century steam engines. Steam engine manufacturers could have made their machines quieter, but they discovered that potential buyers wanted steam engines to make noise. A quiet steam engine just did not seem like it was working very hard. Those buyers, the technological sophisticates of their day, were responding to subtle psychological needs. Though they knew intellectually that their steam engines were producing power, they needed to know emotionally, with their senses, that they were getting the horsepower they paid for. In that analysis, Apple failed by making the Macintosh too subtle, too elegant, too easy to use, and in spite of their protests, too much fun. Incoherence, ugliness, and a steep learning curve were indicators that the machine was powerful. Pain meant gain. Those of us who quickly embraced Macintosh found the attitude depressing. Those in charge of the marketplace regarded computing as a rite of passage, a sort of hazing. Only by acquiring knowledge in this needlessly arcane system could one gain admittance to the society of adepts. It was not a joyous society, but one of stiff upper lips. Macintosh, on the other hand, instantly seemed to attract a joyous cult. Only weeks after Apple shipped the computer, its customers became the machine's key evangelists. Though it is unfair to stick a demographic label on those passionate converts, clearly the most vocal were of yuppie persuasion, embracing the promise of the Mac paradigm with the fervor with which they pursued rock and roll in the 1960s. Though the revenues from those proselytizers was more than welcome at Apple, the phenomenon was not entirely welcome in the executive offices of Cupertino. The very existence of the Mac fanatics fueled the resistance of those of whom Apple was most trying to woo. Instead of reveling in the spectacle of BMUG, the Berkeley Macintosh Users Group, where 400 insanely Macintosh people met every week in an auditorium on the UC campus, Apple cringed in horror. They wore T-shirts. What really terrified Apple's directors was the alleged gulf between the people who designed Macintosh, people like Andy Hertzfeld and Beryl Smith and Bill Atkinson, who probably didn't even own suits, and the Brooks Brothers data processing managers, who finally remembered punch cards. Just because the latter were people who just happened to control the purchases of computers in Fortune 1000 corporations. Poor Apple. It thought that the Macintosh interface, the culmination of the dreams of Bush, Engelbart, and Park, filtered and improved upon by the canny hackers of Banley 3, would take the world by storm. When the revolution failed to materialize, its minions were stunned. I used to think that you couldn't get large numbers of people to really accept personal computers until you had what we delivered: consistent user interface, direct manipulation, modelessness, WYSIWYG, and so on. That you couldn't sell a brain-dead system like DOS to a lot of people. Yet DOS outsold Macintosh, complained Larry Tesler years later. What I don't understand was that most people didn't get to make their own decisions. The mistake we made was assuming that these individuals in MIS positions would have in mind the ease of use of the people who would use them. I never believed they would go by other criteria. I couldn't believe they would spend weeks training people to use a system they hated as opposed to the likable, easy-to-learn Mac interface. Studies show that when people make their own choices, they choose Mac. Something had to be done. John Sculley knew this. All of Apple knew this. Even the Macintosh team knew this. The good news was, the worst flaws of Macintosh were eminently fixable. Compared to the Herculean efforts required to get the machine out the door, it would almost be a routine task to add memory, the capability for a hard disk drive, and maybe even cursor keys. Some improvements had been set in motion well before the Mac's launch. From the start, Apple had planned on a second floppy disk drive to be plugged into a special port at the rear of the Mac, and using it would prevent those 20-minute disk-swapping sessions from hell. When the drive finally became available in the spring, Mac users were so desperate for it that they muted their complaints about the cost, a steep $400. The second tweak was the Fat Mac with 512K memory. Apple finally shipped it in September. Those with original Macintoshes had to pay $1,000 to upgrade their computers to the new standard. They hardly had a choice. Most of the upcoming software for the computer simply would not run on the original standard. But more significant work had to be done to truly bring the Macintosh up to speed, especially the rewriting of the internal code so that a hard disk drive could be supported. At that point, however, the Mac team was burned out, in tatters. After the excitement of getting Macintosh out the door had faded, Joanna Hoffman said to me, "Nobody could go back to a job." Those who tried found themselves listless and uninspired. It was postpartum depression, compounded by shock and horror at the computer's failure to conquer the world. Everyone who worked there identified totally with their work. "We all believed we were on a mission from God," said Randy Wigginton, who had worked furiously during 1984 on a revision of MacWrite, then burned out, spending much of the next year sleeping and watching television. When people didn't buy it, we were majorly depressed. And the Macintosh, their creation, languished. No one was giving orders to do the obvious fixes, the improvements that would allow their wonderful creation to fulfill its potential. "We bailed out too soon," Steve Capps later admitted. Capps himself, after working with Bruce Horn on a bug-correcting update of the Finder, left Apple and lived in Paris for a spell, racking up $10,000 in long-distance charges with collaborators while working on third-party Macintosh programs, mostly involving music. One program, Jam Session, was sort of an instrumental karaoke, allowing the user to sit in on a musical session simply by pressing keys on the Mac keyboard. Bruce Horn had left even earlier. Though he would describe the Mac period as fantastic, in the wake of the Mac's introduction to the market, he felt underappreciated. "I wasn't happy with the distribution of credit," he said, "and I didn't feel I was fairly compensated. Also, I was ready to leave. he went on to work for other Silicon Valley companies. In autumn 1984, Burrell Smith and some of the other survivors decided to end the inertia. They escaped to an isolated warren of cubicles dubbed TurboTown in honor of a new version of the Macintosh they hoped to design. It would have a more powerful microprocessor, more memory, a very sharp monitor that would use grayscale to make images as clear as photographs, and even a hard disk. But inexplicably, the executives terminated TurboMac, and that was the last straw for Burrell Smith. He left Apple, and for years was so bitter that he refused to drive his car anywhere near the Cupertino campus. With Mike Boych, the first Macintosh emissary to third-party developers, Smith went on to form Radius, a company making monitors and other Macintosh peripherals. Even Andy Hertzfeld, who is reputed to bleed the rainbow colors of the Apple logo, left the company. He had never really recovered from his feud with Mac software director Bob Belleville. It seemed to Andy symbolic of the company's increasingly bureaucratic bent. Now, disgusted with the direction of Apple's corporate regime and unhappy at the fate of the Macintosh, he decided he could better support the computer from outside the company. From his Palo Alto cottage, he began devising a new version of the Finder, one that allowed the user to work on more than one application at a time. But he missed Apple. For a month after I left, I cried myself to sleep. And what was Steve Jobs doing? At first, he was busy delivering the Macintosh to various celebrities. He trekked to Mick Jagger's house with Hertzfeld and Atkinson. The Rolling Stone didn't show much interest, so Andy and Bill gave a demo to his daughter Jade. Similarly, Jobs gave a Mac to Beatle offspring Sean Lennon for his 9th birthday. An interviewer for Playboy tracking Jobs watched as the Apple chairman and the boy slipped away from Yoko's A-list party to play with a computer. Looking over their shoulders were Andy Warhol and Keith Haring. Warhol himself sat down at the machine and moved his hand over the mouse. "My God," he said, "I drew a circle." A year later, Warhol was on stage at Lincoln Center, plugging the graphics of a different computer, Commodore's Amiga. Apple Computer's 1984 corporate report featured the putative fruits of 11 of these so-called great imaginations, with stunning black-and-white photographic portraits of recipients and printouts of new work. Kurt Vonnegut used Mac Write to produce the first two pages of his novel Galapagos. It is unknown whether the program required him to open another file at that point. Dianne Feinstein and David Rockefeller were less innovative. They, or their aides, could devise nothing less mundane than schedules and business letters. After the celebrity obsession passed, Jobs became increasingly bogged down in corporate politics. Not long after the Mac launch, Apple merged the Macintosh and Lisa divisions. This made sense, particularly in light of a redesign of Lisa, which allowed it to run,